Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're here. So my name is Andy Battaglia, and I've been involved with Unsound in various ways since first going to the festival in 2009 as a journalist and writing about it, and then starting the next year, kind of helping out to organize Unsound in New York, and then do a bunch of talks at the Mothership Unsound in Krakow, and then in New York, and then elsewhere, and Toronto, and the one thing in Iceland, other places around the world. And
oh, you came here for that?
I did, indeed. Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Which we can talk about. Hung out at your house with Brian Eno.
Oh, that's right.
Drank a bunch of wine.
That's right.
Which was a memorable night. But yeah, and psyched to be here with Ben Frost and Tim Hecker, who are both sort of on the long list of like many artists who have developed like really close sort of deep relationships with Unsound. They're at the top of the top, having performed like starting more than a decade ago. So we can talk about some of that and, you know, all of that in the past year. And then, you know, to start, just for people listening in, like where are you guys presently on the planet, and like what are you seeing and hearing around you right now in the present moment?
I'm in Montreal right now, and I've been here full time for like a year and a half, and I've been lucky to travel a bit. Last summer I managed to sneak away to Europe and see a few friends, but that feels like a distant memory now. We're in like their fourth lockdown, and it's a police state. After 8 p.m., you can't leave the house. I've been lucky because I have an exception written by the government because I'm working on a film project, so I can go to my studio. But it's, you know, it's a real... Montreal's not what it used to be, you know, for sure. It's a really bizarre time. Yeah.
Wow, I didn't realize that was there. You know what I mean?
But yeah, it's been, I don't know, on some level, happy to be here. You know, it's like this past year, you know, forces you to remember what matters, which is, you know, friends, family, you know, your mental health and physical well-being, and nothing else really matters, you know, because our journey in this world is like really fragile. And it's, you know, yeah, I don't know. Reflecting on stuff like that a lot.
Big time. How about you, Ben?
Yeah, I'm in Reykjavik in Iceland. Have been here pretty much the whole time, save for a couple of small kind of exits from the island last year. But essentially I've been here the whole time. So it's just the same as everywhere else. You know, sort of cabin fever is well and truly set in. I mean, Iceland's had it pretty easy by comparison to the rest of Europe, the rest of the world, honestly, maybe with the exception of New Zealand and Australia. It's probably had been the easiest kind of COVID situation.
Yeah.
That said, I feel like the kind of the fallout psychologically is only just starting to kind of really reveal itself here. It's pretty real. And I think, you know, like most places in the world, it feels increasingly difficult when you sort of see these whispers of the rest of the world kind of starting to open up, and, you know, we're sort of here on this rock in the middle of the ocean, still under you know, quarantine restrictions, and it sort of feels like I think people's patience is sort of running out. Mine certainly is.
And how about, so like, yeah, I want to talk about like obviously the past year and stuff, but maybe at the start we can talk about just a little bit about like both of your offerings to the Unsound Intermission album, which, you know, as listeners hopefully know by now, features, you know, 15 tracks commissioned by Unsound from artists who have been involved in with the festival in different ways. And, you know, is also accompanied by a book of essays created kind of in the same vein. And Tim, I mean, can you tell us a little bit about the track that you contributed and how it came to be?
I've been working on a scoring project, and I had this piece that wasn't really used, and it was just kind of in its infancy, and I loved a certain aspect of one of the parts of it. So like I sent it to Matt, and we just, you know, he came up with the idea of like, you know, working with these vocalists, and we had a lot of back and forth and, you know, different takes and stuff, and just, you know, wrote a piece effectively together through that quite quickly and online, like everything else. And, you know, I love it. It's nice offering to the world. It's also like a weird compilation. Like, I haven't done those since I kind of started out doing music, where it's like less and less frequent to take part in compilations. It feels like a quaint mode of, but it's also one of the best, you know, in some ways. When it's good, it's the best, and when it's bad, it's the worst, you know, because often artists just, you know, give their C-tier rejects that don't fit on their albums or singles. And you know, this felt like it was like a lot of people bringing their like best, you know, foot forward or something. And if, you know, I don't know.
And those vocalists are from the Polish like sort of weird folk band, Szauzycz, which means moon in Polish. And they actually played, I think it was 2 years ago, it was like an Unsound New York presentation in a church. And it was like one of the most amazing shows I've ever seen. Did you know their music before like Matt put that together?
No, but I researched them, and they're quite interesting and expressive, and definitely special.
Yeah, absolutely. They in the church, I remember they had these like huge, these large like spherical balloons that they at one point were just like floating all around the room. And then these like glowing orbs that they like had the audience like passing from like hand to hand. It was like totally otherworldly. And for anyone who doesn't know that band, it's definitely worth seeking out. Ben, how about yours? Yours is an excerpt of a longer work made in collaboration with other people. Can you tell us a bit about your track?
I've been working for like a number of years with the Irish photographer and visual artist Richard Moss. That's a collaboration going on 10 years now. We've worked on a couple of pieces together, and the cinematographer Trevor Tweeten. And we started work sort of pre-COVID, the summer before COVID. We started spending quite a bit of time in Brazil, in the Brazilian rainforest, sort of drawing our focus to the sort of sharp escalation of environmental crimes that are occurring under the Bolsonaro government. So we sort of started traveling through the Amazon, starting to get a, yeah, just documenting kind of various aspects of that. It's a really broad and very sort of obtuse kind of set of circumstances that are sort of leading to the overall destruction of the rainforest. My role in that obviously was sound, and I sort of was looking for, like, Richard and Trevor sort of shooting a lot of the material, most of the material, using a form of what would you call it, like a sort of a outer spectrum infrared and ultraviolet film stocks, which are basically able to detect spectrums of light which fall outside of that which we can perceive with our eyes, which is a really kind of interesting analog for a metaphor for the kind of the destruction that's happening down there, because it is largely kind of unseen and weirdly sort of hidden from view. You'll often sort of be driving down these long highways carving through the jungle, and it's wall to wall trees on either side. I mean, the jungle is so thick, you know, you step a meter off the road and you literally can't move further without the aid of a machete. It's just this wall of jungle. But then if you actually progress beyond that, often you'll find within a very short space of time, 5-minute walk from the road, you'll enter these kind of, you know, sort of apocalypse-scapes of just vast, vast burnt areas that are sort of being, are being stripped of the forest in order to turn them into farmland.
Ben, are they doing what they did in BC when I grew up in the 90s, is to make these like scenic corridors. So they make like 100 meters along the road. You feel like you're driving through this old growth forest, but you're basically in this kind of potential
corridor.
Where it's just a hellscape beyond that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just like, it's like pristine rainforest, like in this corridor around the road. And then everything else is soybeans as far as the eye can see. So I was kind of looking for a way to kind of get to that idea in a sort of sonic way. So I started researching. I actually ended up recording a lot of stuff down there using an ultrasonic microphone, which is basically designed for biological research of insects, bats, birds, whales. Basically, it's a microphone that's able to detect frequencies that are a way above our range of hearing, and then through a computer interface, it's essentially using a real-time pitch shifting mechanism to drop those voices down into a way where you can monitor them in real time. So I'm sort of walking through the jungle, recording, recording through that sort of lens of this sort of ultrasonic mic. Where it got really interesting was actually in the fires themselves. The fire itself actually has a whole other sort of octave of sound, several octaves of sound, in fact, above, like lots of whistling and weird sort of pops and crackles and stuff. And so, yeah, in a roundabout way, that's the basis for the piece that sort of made its way onto the compilation.
Amazing. Yeah, Richard Moss has he just opened a gallery show here in New York of those of photos that I'm really psyched to go see. And how, like, I feel like we can go down unsound memory lane a little bit later, but like, I'm curious if you guys, so given the past year and like the weird circumstances and Do you feel like, and I don't know if it's the kind of thing you're able to even recognize yet, or, you know, or if, I don't know how much any of us is able to truly, you know, grapple with what's been going on in a full screen sense, but like, have you, like, has the nature, the relationship between you and like your work changed at all as a result of, like, do you feel like the sort of sounds you're gravitating toward or interested in have been affected by, you know, the circumstances, or, you know, the fact that you're not performing as much as you were prior? Like, do you, have you come to recognize any like changing dynamics that are interesting to you?
I mean, I would say yes. There's definitely been a market change. I would even go so far as to say that it's been sort of problematic for me, in the sense that I'm like, there is a kind of a, you know, by working at home in what is essentially a very small space, my experience has been that, you know, small spaces bring small ideas, you know, and it sort of reduces things for me in a, not in a particularly helpful way. And I'm kind of, as time is going on, I'm becoming more and more sort of conscious of the fact that a lot of the things I'm sort of leaning into are actually things that are very much a reflection of this environment and this time that I'm in right now. Which is absolutely not where I want to be, like, this time next year. So certainly not music I particularly want to perform live. You know, and in a broader sense, it's definitely something I've thought about a lot, like, that, you know, I fear for the, you know, I fear for the future of techno and dance music as a result of that, you know, because it's like, sort of like this weird, there's going to be this weird sort of gap in the record, you know, of I'm curious, but also, you know, it's like, people, how do you make dance music in this space where you're not able to, you know, engage with that world? It's going to be fascinating.
But yeah. Do you recognize, are there like possibilities for like refinement, or sort of like, or it kind of makes me think about, like, you know, like crooners, or like with the advent of like the microphone and like the way that the nature of singing changed from being like, you know, sort of a loud bellowing public broadcast of the voice to something that turned, you know, by dint of like the ability to do so through technology, like, into something like, you know, singing became more intimate and more hushed, and like, you know, there were sort of like added tones and sort of whispered timbres and stuff that entered into the lexicon. Like, can you imagine that once you are able to scale back up, like, there having been, you know, positive results from this? Or is that
like hard to gauge that stuff right now, because we'll look back in 15 and 20 years and see the like economic and technological ways it affected music that right now is not probably clear, because we're all in this mire of isolation and confusion and kind of low-grade depression, and for some people like high-grade depression. And I think it's, yeah, that will emerge. I mean, I personally, you know, struggled with inspiration like probably anyone else. At the beginning, it was kind of fun and mysterious and bizarre and cinematic in some ways. And it slowly devolved into like some kind of, you know, hellscape at times, and sometimes better. I mean, I've been really lucky because I've had a few projects that have allowed me to survive. But, you know, I worry about like my friend of house engineer. I've checked in with him a few times, who, you know, his only work was playing shows primarily, and was on the road, you know, 300 days a year. And, you know, I'm really concerned about people like that, even booking agents. And, you know, there's a whole industry that's gotten smashed. And I think it's like, yeah, it's just hard, you know, to envision things opening up and how that affects your music. And I'm trying not to be too strategic about things, about like, getting a record ready for some kind of period. Like, I'm not in a rush to do anything. And, you know, at the end of last year, it was like quite high velocity for me. I was playing like all over the place with a 5-person ensemble. It was complicated and flying all the time. And I mean, there's some upside, like I don't need to be in a plane every week or two, you know, it's like, it was crazy. I'm not a, you know, what's the Swedish word for the anti-air travel movement? I'm not quite there, but I think reducing it is positive, you know, staying more grounded in your home, your community, and your family. For me personally, yeah, I do not know. It's a tough one. And I think music is evolving. And that's like, you know, I'm not going to talk about NFTs and shit like that, but I feel that there's a rupture that's happening right now. That's going to, like, who is inspired to make a work that costs like, I don't know, $2,000, $15,000, $20,000 to just feed into the Spotify machine, you know, or a beggar's bank, you know, beggar's deal that you get 25% for life and they own the masters. The record industry is fucked straight up. And, you know, there's going to be some changes that will hopefully, you know, I think be more fair towards the people that put, you know, 95% of their, you know, creative labor into making works. And that's just kind of, you can see what's happening, but it's slow motion. And, you know, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that there's like even beyond that, I think there's a really interesting kind of, there's a kind of a rupture anthropologically in the way that these kind of, these environments that we're all in right now, literally, you know, you're in your office or something, Andy, I'm here in ground floor of my house in the spare room, you know, it's like we're in these kind of, you know, hermetic kind of, you know, several square meters of space. You know, that like one thing I think about a lot is the way language is kind of developed as a result of space. I think that Icelandic is a really good example of a language that has developed as a result of confined spaces, for example. You know, it's a language. It's not a shouting language. It's not loud. It's kind of the opposite of Australian English in that way. You know, whereas Australian English is very sort of has this sort of chiseled kind of insanity about it, where it works to be broadcast across wide space. And I think the same is true of American English and you know, Canadian English even. I think Icelandic is a whispered language. It's all in the front of your mouth.
We're slightly more quiet than Americans, which need to, like, you know, generally. I mean,
right, it's colder.
No, we have a lot of important shit to say over here.
Yeah, that's right. Especially to everyone, Andy.
Indeed. Yeah, that's funny you say that about Icelandic, though, because, like, to the extent that I have ever been able to even begin to pronounce an Icelandic word, like I feel like I had a like revelation once when, you know, cause they're all like 7 syllables long. And I realized that to say the word was like, it basically like required saying all of the syllables simultaneously rather than like as a succession of syllables, if that makes sense. Like, it's kind of just like, cause I was trying to like break the word down and put it into a sequence. And then it was like, but then it was like, no, you actually just have to say them all at once. And like, that's
right.
That sort of that front of the mouth.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
But I think this thing of like the way that kind of like the enclosed space is kind of actually physically affected the language itself. I suspect that there's probably, you know, and going back to your kind of comment about the crooners and the development of microphone technology, I think that a similar thing is probably happening now. You know, it's going to take a while to see it, but I can totally imagine that's what's happening. It's kind of the by closing the walls in around music.
And so would you like guess that would involve more reverberant or less reverberant music? Like, generally, yeah, things are already going towards like a laboratory style anechoic type of pop, like, right? Like the kind of washed out nature of the 80s with like the Lexicon and Eventide, you know, tails on everything is.
Yeah, but they, like, but then they, but then they chiseled them off as well. It's like just railing lines of cocaine and how that all kind of like lined up with, you know, the gated reverb of the 80s. It is really like this kind of compartmentalization of space. You know,
yeah, gated like, is true.
Yeah, I don't know. It's gonna be weird to kind of see how it goes. I think it's quite telling right now that, you know, I mean, what was it like Mogwai got like a number one record? You know, it's not like they've reinvented their wheel. They're still doing exactly what they've been doing for the last 20 years. But all of a sudden, you know, they have a massive audience that has kind of opened up to them. And, you know, that has to kind of speak to a shift in people's listening habits. And therefore, you know, I have to believe that that's going to have an effect on, like, the kind of music people are making as well.
What do you think, Andy, turn on you, like, what do you think about music writing? Like, I don't find myself reading much music criticism right now. And is that like a reflection of me personally, or is that a reflection of the like writing scape in general? It's like, and platforms and things like that. And they're like, you know, all their, you know, issues related to ownership and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, that's a tough one. I mean, it's no secret to anyone that, you know, there are fewer and fewer places for people to even begin to write about music, like much less to write interestingly about it. And I think, I don't know, it, like for me, I feel a little bit distanced from that question only because like, so yeah, I mean, I work at an art magazine now and like, you know, I'm a little bit more, I mean, I still write about music and sound, and it's obviously like one of my main interests, but like, it's been a long time since I was like pitching like music reviews or essays expressly about just music. So thankfully I haven't had, I mean, it's not like the art journalism landscape is like some fertile, you know, amazing ground by comparison, but it's like at least a little bit healthier.
But there must be some like coalition of writers that exists outside the kind of middle-aged wire UK kind of world, you know. Surely, I mean, I just don't know of it.
Yeah, and you know, I always wonder, you know. Or just for like young, like aspiring, emerging, you know, music writers, you know, if in fact there are people who still aspire to such a station in life, I'm just really curious because I like where, you know, where they would begin, or you know, because like
it's like a great time to organize and start new platforms, you know, they probably already exist, and I'm just like not looking for them, but. You know,
yeah, no, definitely. It seems like, I mean, I would imagine in this, you know, like akin to the way that you spoke about like there being like a reordering or a reshuffling of like the music business, the record industry, like, you know, that, you know, I mean, the media landscape is going through similar kinds of things with like no small amount of uncertainty, you know, attending all of those questions. Are you, Tim, are you at liberty to talk about the scoring project that you're working on presently?
Yeah, I think it's fine. I mean, I worked the last year on two projects. One was a small, like crazy Austrian art house film. But one was a pretty massive 5-hour long BBC film epic that stars, that's directed by Andrew Haig and has, yeah, it's quite a, you know, quite an intense project, and I worked on it for about a year. And it was my, you know, my kind of leprechaun at the end of the rainbow of COVID that like allowed me to have some order and, you know, resources, luckily, to like survive this period. And yeah, it was a real immense learning experience on so many levels to like get a skill set that I think Ben probably knows quite well. And I don't know, I think it will probably come out in the fall. It's called The North Water. And it's a 5-part. It's like essentially 5-hour film divided into 5 episodes, miniseries type of thing.
Very cool. And Ben, I mean, you've worked increasingly in sort of different kinds of areas, like including scoring and, I'm curious, like, in addition to, making Ben Frost music and like, via records and like performing, by yourself, like how have you come to consider like those other ways of working as like part of like your greater whole? Like are they sort of separate? Do you have separate working methods and like ideas that you course through in those kinds of projects, or are they, is there a consistent through line through everything you're working on in different contexts?
Yeah, it's a good question. It is, working with film in particular is a very it's a dangerous game to play, like in terms of keeping a sense of, vision about what it is I'm trying to do and where it is I'm trying to go, following my kind of instincts. Because, in the best scenario, what you want from a film is that you essentially get to collaborate with somebody who allows you to do literally whatever it is that you want to do, and finds a way to kind of fold that energy that you have into their thing, so it, and the collaboration is fruitful on the basis that, you basically just smash these things together and it kind of, it's greater than the sum of its parts. But invariably that's the, that is the 1% of situations, and the rest is a kind of nightmare escape of soul crushing slave labor.
Talk about the death, the dangerous game, because it's like, I can see easily losing your kind of independent artistic mojo. I've seen happen so many times,
exactly. And it's definitely something that I feel like in the last couple of years, like sort of pre-COVID, I definitely sort of touched the void in that sort of scenario, and have been struggling to kind of come back from it, honestly. Where this space of writing music with a sort of set functionality in mind makes writing music at once easier, but it also doubles down how hard it is to write music for its own sake afterwards. So it's like, I'm sure there's a good drug analogy in there somewhere. It really feels like kind of, like trying to get off something, kind of coming out the other end of that. And, and honestly, the last year for me has been just kind of coming to terms with that, recognizing that that's what's happened, and trying to kind of carve a way out of it. But at the same time, also being hamstringed by the kind of the circumstances wherein I can't just, as I've done with all my previous kind of records, go out and try shit on the road and use the, like, I mean, at some point touring a record for me, like there comes a point where the sound check literally takes 15 minutes, but I always budget in 3 hours for it. And so, you know, in the best circumstances, I'll have a couple of hours with, you know, with a stage and where I can work at volume and play around with things and really kind of just use that sort of laboratory of the touring kind of machine to kind of work things out for myself.
Also, concerts are like that, you know, like,
yeah,
the feedback absolutely. From a body of people, you can tell energetically where work has vibrance mm-hmm. and connection and work that doesn't. You can feel it almost coming back from the stage. And
yeah,
that helps going back and writing music, you know. You don't totally. Get inspired for sure.
And so that for me was always like very much at odds with the kind of the film music paradigm, which is, you know, me alone in a room staring at a screen. And so to kind of not have, you know, the cycles kind of broken in there, to go directly from one into the other, but for the environment to remain the same, for the circumstances to be unchanged, it really is a fucking exercise in, you know, sort of personality transplant to kind of get there. And, you know, trying to, I don't know. I mean, Tim, I know you and I talked about this a bit, this kind of like finding these ways to kind of like separate those things, you know? I remember you mentioned some point a couple months ago, you were talking about how, like, you know, you were like dividing your week up into, like, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday is, you know, film, and then Thursday, whatever. I don't remember how it was.
Yeah, I'm really not a multitasker. You know, I can't have like three artistic or creative projects on the go at the same time. It literally spins me out because I just go hamster down the burrow 100% into something, and I can't really let go until it's somewhere good, but I can't really shelve it half-baked. And I feel like the best works are kind of immediate and quick and happen within a period of time. But these long going, like a scoring project that starts as a creative engagement in an ideal sense, like you're saying, with the director, devolves into this technical kind of exercise of like cutting bass on a cello or like fade ins to like match picture. And it becomes like the creativity dies, and then you don't get that vessel in the same way. And it seems like, yeah, like a K-hole that maybe is difficult to come back from. And yeah, I mean struggle with. I also feel that every time I personally write a record, it's like an existential shadow boxing or dread match, you know, that is always difficult. And I think just having these pauses where you didn't do that for a long period of time, it's always difficult to like start again and get really honed into something. And yeah,
but also just that thing of like I don't know, like recognizing that, like, what you do for the first, like, when you make that decision to like, okay, now I'm gonna write music, you know, I'm gonna write new record, it's like you kind of go into that realizing that you're gonna spend the next half a year hating absolutely everything you do. And it's like you need to sort of like write your way out of it somehow. There's no way to circumvent it, you know.
I'm curious, like, given the context there's so much to. It's insane to think back on, like, sort of the unsound sort of memory bank. But I'm curious if there's like one. What's your craziest unsound memory, or if not crazy, at least like most resonant, or like what rises to mind most immediately when you think back on? Because I was trying to tally up the number of times that both of you have performed, and I had to give up counting at a certain point.
I've had lots of shows there. I've done a pipe organ one, I think just after Rave Death, I think that got me banned. Or I think that was the show I did with Dan Lopatin, One O Tricks, that was I think we got excommunicated from that church because of the volume. I mean, there was like, so much kind of to think about in the history. Like, Matt and Gosh are incredibly generous and crazy and creative people, you know, in the way they construct their festival. And it's always felt special. Like, there's the time I filled this factory with smoke that just, you think in like health and fire regulations, just would not fly in any other country or place. It was crazy. You couldn't see more than like 1 foot in front of you. I don't know what else. I did like a trumpet in a tower. I mean, there's been, you know, it's a really vibrant place. And yeah, for many years, I was happy to go there in October.
Yeah. Ben, you have a history with that same church, the St. Catherine's Church, which was like a 16th century church in Krakow. I remember that was actually the first year I ever went was 2009, but I think I remember that year you performed as part of the whale watching tour with Nico Muley and
Sam. Yeah, yeah.
But the year before you performed in that church, right?
Yeah, I think so. It was somewhere in there, 2007, 2008. Yeah, I got banned for that too. But yeah, it's kind of
a lot of excommunication going on.
Yeah, I think it was a good sign.
Yeah, and I remember, yeah. Ben, I remember the first time I ever met you, it was in 2010, I went back and did like my first panel talk ever in Krakow, and it was, you were on it, and it was in Lustmord and in Xenial also. And I remember Matt Schultz, the director of Unsound, he was scaring the shit out of me because Lustmord hadn't performed publicly in many, I think 30 years or something, save for like one show he had done for the Church of Satan. And I remember Matt just like telling me that Lustmord was going to eat me alive on stage and like, you know, chew me up and spit me out. And he, of course, like Brian Lustmord, like turned out to be like the sweetest guy who became a friend over the years. But you were on that panel too, and I remember it was like a little tea shop in Kazimierz. Crazy. Any other like Unsound? What about Toronto? That was another thing I was thinking. So when Unsound Toronto,
I remember Tim's show really well there. That was fucking crazy.
There were two, right, Sam? Because
the ephemeral one or the one on the main stage?
The ephemeral one, yeah. The one where you literally couldn't see.
Yeah, we had like perfume dispensers. I can't remember if we put the drone perfume that we made into the foggers, but you know,
it was that scent, yeah.
For sure. The backline for that type of show is like three times what a stadium, you know, rock or stadium type of show would use. But we've got these industrial foggers that were made for, you know, stadiums, and just turned them on like from every angle. And, you know, it's kind of the end point of like how dense you can make, you know, or negate the field of vision or make it about sound by just making the inability to see a kind of part of it, you know. The other option is darkness, of course, which is also effective, but that felt like a, you know, a happy place because it was just these color fields, you know, that were pulsing from different, you know, vectors of the space. And you know, it was really like great. It was also just removed the kind of performative center of the kind of table or the stage center, you know, where the maker of sound, you know, is doing the work, and it was coming from every direction, and there was no center point. And for me, that, you know, was felt good to like, you know, be part of, and it was fun, you know, to play music in, because it's just you know, a huge sound system of like really good spec that makes the music you're working on sound really in a different context. And
yeah, in that setting, I mean, that the setting of that building in general was like the decommissioned power plant in Toronto that was just like one of the most wild structures of any kind I've ever been in.
My favorite memory of that day actually was there was a pair of peregrine falcons nesting in the top of the building. And I remember like when we were sound checking, like sort of glancing over and watching this like falcon just like completely pulverize this pigeon, like right next to the stage. And then sort of walking across to kind of take a look at it, and you just see this like this bird, like kind of almost like a kind of school bully kind of stance of like 1 foot either side of this pigeon who was like on its back, and the falcon was just kind of like pinning it down, and then it sort of would like look up at you. It was like looking up at me. It was like, what? And then it just went back to eating this thing alive. And that was, yeah, that was in the middle of sound check.
That's when you knew it was loud enough.
Right.
How much, like, are you guys even thinking about performing yet? Like, is the notion of like, you know, have you allowed your imagination to go there, or are you kind of like hedging your bets for a while?
I can miss it so much. I really miss it.
I'm like not there, you know, creatively. I have, you know, I love traveling and happy to play shows, but I'm not like planning a rollout of a future ensemble or structure or whatever at any, like right now, I'm just trying to make music and not think instrumentally about its, you know, broadcast, you know. And I think, but I do miss traveling, you know. It's like there's something about, you know, this situation, being able to go to certain cities like once a year, and you get this kind of like, you know, in the time of like Trumpism and nationalism and, you know, anti-cosmopolitan globalism in some ways, you know, being like in some ways like a global citizen, like having friends all over the world, and traveling was an incredible privilege that you see in retrospect that is, you know, it's not the same. And it's like a reckoning. And it's, you know, there's times I do miss that, you know, but that's, you know, yeah.
Yeah, it was hard this past October when Unsound didn't happen. I mean, it happened online and very interestingly, but like not in Krakow, obviously. And like it was, because, you know, for me, one of the most eye-opening things for me, like getting involved with Unsound, was coming to recognize like how like touring musicians, like you guys, and like artists, there was this whole world of like what you called global citizens, like people who are just like making their way around the world, like literally week by week, and in ways that I think are hard to comprehend, like for anyone who hasn't been exposed to that. And so it's hard. And, you know, it's interesting reading through the book, the Unsound Intermission book, like with people just trying to, you know, reckon with the fact that they're just like not, you know, people who are like very traveled, well-traveled people, like very much not traveling at all.
It's like a heroin addiction in a different form, you know, like also on a personal level, when there's issues, you know, you just don't worry because you're going somewhere in a few weeks. And the benefit of this was, you know, forcing you to stay present in those issues and stay grounded in a sense of place. But the downside is you were addicted to going to different places every week or two as a way of like energizing yourself, but it was also a form of evasion from the self in my personal sense of things personally. And that there's been fruit from that, you know, you see, you know, your tendencies as a person, as a friend, as a partner, as a father, whatever. And try to see the, you know, the flowers out of the weeds in some sense, you know.
I mean, just on a kind of irrespective of the machinations of touring, like just the stage, you know, like I mean, music for me is a very physical thing, you know, and I really thrive on that. And so for me, a lot of this last year has been kind of reflecting on that and really sort of mourning the kind of loss of it, in that just not being able to, that feeling of the weird smell of, you know, fog machines and kind of that weird combination of tube amplifiers and crackling PAs and stale beer and and then, you know, just, yeah, like low frequencies so fucking massive that, you know, they make you go blind on certain notes, you know. It's like it's that for me is music kind of goes into a sort of an ecstatic bodily kind of meditation at that point. And I realize more and more now how much I've kind of leaned into that as a, not only as an artist, but just as a human. There's something incredibly, I don't know. There's a certain kind of self-care in it for me that, yeah, has kind of gone away as a result of this whole situation. So, yeah, I mean, I miss it fucking every day right now. And I can't wait to get back out there.
Yeah. How loud are you able to get at home? I wonder what it's like to be Ben Frost's neighbor.
It's not even close to the same. Like, it's like, you know, you can't do it in a residential home. It just doesn't, it's not the same.
And just as a parting question, like, because we've been talking for a while now, but like, are you either or both of you, are you working on anything like currently that you're like excited about or that you sort of see on the horizon that you can share?
I'm just like, you know, stringing up old Lucille again and just playing music for absolutely no purpose or utility or output and just zero agenda. I'm just trying.
Dad jams.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe, you know, like some, like, why did we do this in the first place? You know, it's like something that was like incredibly passionate about. And I'm trying not to do with any sense of, you know, I have some time now. So it's just like, you know, remember why you love this and why, you know, I don't listen to that much music right now, like in terms of expanding my horizons. You know, I'm kind of on just a dial tone about that. And I'm just trying to make things myself and play around and have no agenda and grow a little bit, you know, get a bit better at my keyboard skills and, you know, write things with a bit of a different approach and just trying to make music, you know, really.
Yeah. That makes me think of, there's an artist, Carol Beauvais, who's one of my favorite artists working right now. She's based here in New York, a sculptor. And she makes like really large scale steel bent sculptures that are, you know, involve cranes and just like works at a scale that is, you know, is huge. But she was talking about having taken a pottery class and like just like ceramics, like throwing, you know, pots on the wheel, and how it was really great because she didn't really know what she was doing, but also she mentioned like just the thrill of making something without the lust for result was very mm-hmm. interesting to her. And I thought that phrase, like the lust for result, was really fascinating, and like doing away with it and just sort of forgetting about it all together is like kind of refreshing and can kind of make for like a reset of some kind.
Yeah, it's exactly what I'm talking about. It's just a like non-strategic sense of just making things for yourself that, you know, it feels that the demons can like stop talking for a while, or that, you know, you're whatever it is you're going to as a substitute for a meditative practice, or, you know, it's not easy, but once you're like in that mindset, I have to make a new record and it has to be released on this date and I have this tour, you're locked in this whole labyrinth that you've created for yourself that precludes some becoming and precludes some sense of growth as a person. And I think that, hopefully there's some ego shattering parts of this past year that can carry on in a positive way to, you know, how the world evolves and how time passes and how we all get on as humans in our like trajectory of our lives.
How about you, Ben? Have your demons stopped talking, or are they chattering still?
I don't know, man. I mean, I'm certainly in like this place trying to not think about where all this kind of ends up, just working for the sake of working. That said, I feel that there's a kind of a, I don't know, maybe I'm too working class to kind of sit around waiting for something to hit me. So I like my sort of way through this last year has just been to put my head down and just hammer at it. So I have a lot of material and a lot of things I'm kind of chipping away at, but they also feel like weirdly, you know, I watched this documentary about, you know, you remember that piece Christo did in Santa Barbara, the big white fence thing, this kind of big sail that he put through like California there. This huge like thing,
the,
but
like through the valley.
Yeah, exactly. And just how that, like the act itself, like the actual physical manifestation of that was, you know, it existed for, I don't know, 10 days or something before it was, you know, taken down. It was like the actual physical object itself was really only there for such a fleeting moment. But how, you know, this idea, you know, the plan, the sketches, the kind of the image had just been in his head for so long. And, you know, watching that, like I really felt a great deal of sort of empathy towards his insane frustration and his like crazy temper, which is really kind of obvious in this documentary. The frustration of not being able to have a realization of the thing, but just for it to all be sort of stuck in his head. And it feels a little, familiar to me right now, like in that the kind of music I'm writing and the kind of ideas I'm sort of trying to chip away at, they don't fit in this room, you know, they don't fit in this like headphone, like children sleeping upstairs kind of space. Like they're not made for this scale. And so, yeah, that for me right now is the battle, is trying to kind of like hold, like on one hand sort of hold the image like sort of crystalline in, you know, and hold that in focus and not like allow it to degrade through, you know, through circumstance, but also kind of like, I don't know, try and take a lesson from it, you know, like enjoy the kind of gestational aspect of it, however prolonged it may be. I don't know, man. I'm not going to say it's fun. It hasn't been fun for me. How about you?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just plugging along. I feel like I don't work at the, you know, the kind of scale or in the kind of public facing way that you guys do. So it's like, it's really hard for me to imagine the absence of that. You know, I mean, the only thing, like, I once did a talk, it was at the Moog Fest, with Michael Stipe, and it was a, you know, who's obviously like a pretty big, you know, rock star. And he, it was in a big theater, and there were probably 500 or 600 people there. And when we walked out on stage, like, there was this like wave of ovation, like, which is basically just like people screaming and clapping, and like that, like was like a physical sort of, you know, like palpable presence. And like, I had never experienced that. Like, generally people, when I walk into a room, it's rare to get, you know, that kind of reaction. Obviously.
I feel that way, Andy.
I would apply if you came on stage on your own.
Yeah. Well, that's nice to hear. Yeah. I mean, it was incredible experience for me, because it was just like, God, like what must it be like to not only experience that, like, even once, but like to have that be a consistent part of your, you know, your life. Yeah, I think that about DJs all the time too. It's like, when, you know, the handful of number of times where I've managed to be like one of those like cheesy guys in the back of the stage, like as a DJ is playing, and it's just looking out over the crowd and like watching like, you know, thousands of people react like and dance and like lose their minds. Like, it's just like, to imagine like being in the presence of that all the time, and not only being in the presence, but like actually being the cause of it.
I think that's like an interesting feedback loop that it like affects everybody. I mean, I remember being at like Primavera Sound in like the mid 2000s backstage, and Genesis Peorge was there playing with Psychic TV. And I remember they were really fixated on the press they were getting, like some stupid, you know, generic milquetoast newspaper writing about their show. And it was, for me, quite surprising how it felt kind of superficial. Like, who cares what these people think, you know? And it was, you know, that affects even, you know, some of the great.
Maybe even more so, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah, it's a feedback loop. And I think all that stuff I was talking about, like, you know, meditative forms of like, you know, dealing with ego and like the self and expectations are ultimately good, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I very much like look forward to seeing and hearing you guys perform again sometime in the world. And yeah, like, can't thank you enough for like joining in on this. And like, thanks to Unsound too for just like providing the context. I mean, for this talk, but then also for like, you know, it's been like over a decade now of the, and like literally the list of like shows I remember you guys both playing, like I just couldn't even finish it because it was just like too many. So here's hoping there are more to come. Yeah, and like, thanks a ton.
Cheers to that. Thanks, Andy. Ben.
Yeah. Thanks, Andy. Let's talk with Tim.
Okay. Yeah. So,
all right, guys.
All right. See you later.
Thank you.